Hey everyone, Dana here. So we are actually cutting this season of El Empire a little bit short. This will be our final episode. With everything happening in the world, we're just trying to refocus and kind of reshuffle our priorities across the company. That said, thank you so much for everyone that's been listening to El Empire this season and last. We've enjoyed producing every second of this show. So, for our final episode, who could be more fitting to round this all out than our very own Hibba Fisher, my favorite CEO in the world, co-founder of Kernan Cultures, the Middle East's first venture-backed podcast network. Hibba launched Kernan Cultures with co-founder Razana Zayani in 2015, and since 2017 has been running the network solo. That means raising money, pitching shows, producing stories, running marketing, organizing listening events, and a million other things that frankly I do not know how she fits into her day. Hibba works harder than anyone I know. I spoke to her one evening last week. I was at home in LA. Hibba was in Seattle. I actually love that we're on the same time zone. She was in her closet and I was in this makeshift setup that our sound engineer, Mohamed Khreizat, had helped me build via FaceTime. This was likely the 1,000th time I've spoken to her across the 6 years of working together. But this time was a bit emotional for me. You know, Kernan Cultures' growth has been so rapid that we hadn't ever before stopped and looked backwards. And you know, every podcast and every episode that we air marks a moment in our lives for each of us on the team. And if I can be personal for a little bit, Kernan Cultures has been a part of my life for 6 years now. And in those 6 years, I've had some of the happiest and hardest moments of my life. And so as I sat down to interview Hibba about the past, all of this kind of came up to the surface. And, you know, without even knowing it, Hibba and this team has been a source of support and strength and deep friendship for me throughout everything. And I can't tell you how much that means to me. So I tried really hard to keep it together during this interview, but there are moments where I burst into tears. Luckily, one of the perks of working here is that I get to edit those parts out. I loved getting to know Hibba in a way that I hadn't before, and I hope you do too. I want to thank our amazing team for really being so excited about this episode, and particularly Shahed Bani Oudeh, who was the one that WhatsApped me after our weekly check-in calls and said I absolutely had to do an interview with Hibba as our final episode, and she was totally right. So Shahed, thank you. Another thing I want to mention is that this episode is much longer than usual. Given it's Hibba and given it's our last episode, we thought it would be a good idea to just let it all out. So I hope you stick with us.
It was everywhere.
I used to tell my father, you will see one day, I will make a film and I will go to Cannes. I don't know why I say that.
I felt insulted.
I was like, where is my audience?
I didn't go to therapy. I think I should.
This is El Empire. Stories of exceptional Arabs around the world and their journey to the top.
I don't think I asked you this, but like of your journey building KC, I want to know the highest high that you felt and the lowest low that you felt.
Well, I will say that it's been a roller coaster, and I think it'll continue to be a roller coaster. The biggest high was when we closed our seed round and when the first check hit our bank account, and it was more money than I've ever had in my bank account. And I literally, I took a screenshot and sent it to our family WhatsApp group. I was really proud. Again, because not only are we an Arab company, an Arab startup, we're a media company. company and we're run by women. Like, this is like the trifecta of hard to try and get investment capital for. So that was legit. That was really great. I think the hardest low was when Rizan, when my co-founder, stepped back. I think that was the hardest low. Like, I love her. We're still very good friends, alhamdulillah, and we were very good to each other through it. But it really did feel like getting a divorce. To have somebody say I'm not along for this ride anymore. That was really, really hard. And I of course I respect her decision, but that was moving past that and figuring out how to rebuild, really.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay.
I can hear you.
Are you recording?
I am recording. I'm recording.
Hiba, I've prepared zero questions for you. So we're just going to wing this one.
That sounds great.
Okay. So many questions. But first, the biggest one of all. Do you, Hiba Fisher, agree to this interview and that Kerning Cultures holds all rights to edit and do whatever we want with your audio?
Yes. I agree.
Okay. What was your day like today? Tell me.
What was my day like today? I woke up at 5 o'clock. I'm in Seattle, and so I had a call at 5:30 with some people in Dubai, and I had a couple of calls thereafter, and then I went back to sleep for an hour because the bed was really appealing. And then I've just been sitting at the kitchen table working. We're all under quarantine. And so I worked for a couple of hours and then I went with my dad, who's here. He's been here for a week and a half, alhamdulillah. He came in from Jeddah. We went to the grocery store and bought way more things than we needed to. And now I'm talking to you.
Hiba, I kind of wanted to start at the very beginning. You have three siblings. And what do you think your siblings would say if I asked them what you were like as a kid?
Okay, well, for context, I'm the youngest of three siblings. I have my older sister, Aya. She's 5.5 years older than me. And then my brother, Bido, his real name is Abdullah. And then Timo, nickname, his real name is Taimur. And then me. And so, as a little kid, and I would say probably up until even like 5 or 6 years ago, I adored my sister very much and wanted to be just like her and drove her crazy because I imitated everything that she did and tried to wear all her clothes without asking. And my brothers, I would say growing up, I was closer to my brothers because we were closer in age. And so Timo and I would make up these games for us to play around the house, like hide and seek. But to catch the other person, you had to like stick your foot in their face, which was really fun. And my other brother, Bido, and I were the quieter ones in the family. And so I think we just like our souls are a lot more aligned. And so I would have long conversations with him until this day. But how they would describe me growing up, so my sister would describe me as annoying. my brothers, I think, they'd probably call me a bookworm as well. I used to read a ton of books. We lived in New Jersey when I was younger, and so there were public libraries, and we'd go to the public library, and I'd get a bag full of like 50 books at a time. They were like stupid books, by the way. There was this series called Sweet Valley High that which was...
Yeah, I used to read it too.
Do you know Sweet Valley, my dad?
I did. We had so many of them too.
They're really...
So many.
It's a very empty-headed book. And so my dad would always... he had this policy that for every... I think it was for every three or for every five Sweet Valley High books, I had to get one like intellectual book. And so there was like some historical book in there or something or other. But I read a lot growing up.
Do you remember any of those books that like you still think of or you went back to or that you remember?
A lot of them. There's actually one sitting in our bookshelf right now, and I don't know. I think my sister picked it up recently. It's called The Power of One, and it's about this boy in South Africa who learns how to box. And I remember reading that in middle school, and that's why I started kickboxing. So that's one of the books.
Wait, you kickbox?
I do. I started in high school. I trained... It's a type of martial arts called Zendo kickboxing in Bahrain. Was where I learned, and so I trained for 4 years, and then I was training in college as well. I never sparred. I don't know how to punch somebody, by the way, but I enjoy going up against a bag. It's a nice way to relieve stress, and so I was part of a team for a while, and then I've just been I find gyms that have boxing bags, and so I go by myself.
That's amazing.
I can't beat anybody up, but I have a pretty tough punch.
I'm sure you can. Have you ever tried? You probably can.
No, I've never tried. I've never tried.
I'm sure you can. I never knew this about you. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But a lot of people, when they hear your name, especially on Kernan Cultures, they hear an Arab first name and a foreign last name. Can you break the mystery for everyone about your background?
Yeah. It's pretty simple, and you can hear it in my name. My mother's Egyptian and my father's American. So my dad's name is Fisher. And my parents decided to name me Hiba because I was actually an accident as a child. And my mom didn't want any kids after the first three. And then she had a beautiful perspective to call me Hiba, which means gift in Arabic.
How did your parents meet?
Oh, they have an epic love story. So my dad was working in Cairo at the time. So as an American, this is in the 70s. And so he was working for a consulting firm, and they had this position overseas, and nobody in the office wanted to go to Egypt. And my dad said, oh, I'll go. That sounds cool. And so he was working there for a while. And then through friends, he ended up meeting my mom, who had just moved back from Paris. She'd been in Paris for about 8 years working as a translator for the UN. And if you can put this in context, my mom's approaching her late 20s as a single Egyptian lady, not married. And so her parents were like, come back home and get married, please. So she moved back to Alexandria, where my family's from. And she was actually, she was basically engaged to this really wealthy Egyptian guy when she met my dad through mutual friends. And the way that she talks about it, she says that this other potential man was the kind of person that she'd have to wear makeup to bed for, like she'd just be a trophy wife. But when she met my father, she felt really comfortable, and my dad would write her poetry and and all this stuff. And so they fell in love, and it was a huge scandal in the family because my dad is white and American, and at the time he was Christian, but he embraced Islam. And then even when that happened, there's stories in my family. So my dad was living in Cairo. My mom was in Alexandria, which is about a 2-hour distance by car. And so he came like 7 times to her house to ask for her hand in marriage, and nobody would open the door because he was this Yani Wahid Aganab. He's this foreigner. And And then finally, it was my eldest. My grandfather had already passed away at this point. So it was my eldest uncle, Alirhamu, who said, like, look, he's Muslim. So it's if it's okay in the eyes of God, then who are we to say no just because he's not of our culture?
Did he convert for you? Converted for your mom?
He did. He did. So they ended up getting married, and I learned this only recently that another uncle, it was a huge, huge scandal in the family. Very few people came to the small celebration that they had. And then even my uncle, who I love very, very much, another uncle, not the one that said it was okay for them to get married, didn't speak to my parents for years. And now everybody loves my dad, and it's not an issue at all. And my mom jokes that she took like all the garbage in the family. And now so many of my cousins and aunts and uncles have married, you know, French partners or German or whatever it might be. And she's like, I took all the zavala, I took all the trash and paved the way for you. But my mom's always been a rebel like that.
I often hear you talk about your parents. It's one of the things that I really love about you. And I know that they've always been really supportive, but can you tell me what they're like as people?
They're both very different. So my mom taught me how to love. Like she's one of those mothers. She had a very successful career, and then she put everything on the side to take care of us kids, and she's literally dedicated her whole life to raising us and to our family. And she taught us, you know, really how to be together as a family. And we're very, very close, all of us siblings and our extended family as well. And my mom also taught me strength. She's one of the strongest people that I know. And she also has this insane sense of humor that comes out of nowhere because she's like, you meet her. So you meet her and she's kind of a foreboding personality when you meet with her. But if you sit with her long enough, and then she cracks you up in the most unexpected ways. And my dad, I think, taught all of his kids a very strong work ethic. He's very entrepreneurial. He's such a curious mind as well. Yani, mashallah, I remember when I was in high school, he got his PhD, and this was quite late in his life, When he got his PhD, I remember he turned to me and he said, you know, Hiba, one of the reasons that I studied at this age in my career is I wanted to teach you kids that you never stop learning, you know, like life [S2] Yeah. [S1] is all about learning. And it's something that I hold very, very dear to me. And my dad is someone you can get into, like, I mean, we kind of tease him as kids, but he's always interested in another business idea. And so I've learned about, you know, farming grasshoppers and Islamic insurance and financial literacy apps. And just every other year, there's like another business endeavor that he's excited about. And I think that that's really incredible that he's so excited by life still. I don't think he'll ever retire. Those are my two parents.
So you grew up where? Talk to me about like you were born and then where you grew up and where you ended up going to school.
We moved around a lot. So I was born in the States. I was born in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. And then we lived in New Jersey for the first 12 years of my life. So I was born, we moved immediately to New Jersey. And then when I was about 12, we moved to Jeddah. So my dad got a job working for an investment bank in Jeddah. And he'd actually moved a year or two before us, which was really, really hard growing up and not having my dad around as often. He used to travel a lot. And then that period, I remember, was really, really hard. So we joined him in Jeddah. And I went to middle school in Jeddah. And then from Jeddah, we moved to Bahrain. Switched jobs for another investment bank in Bahrain at the time. And so I went to high school in Bahrain. And both of those periods were wonderful. They were really, really, really beautiful times. And I think it was like growing up, I don't know if you had this experience, Dana, because I know you spent some time in the States, but growing up as a mixed kid, half Egyptian, half American in the US, like the U.S. teaches you to assimilate, and that to be different is, you know, wrong. And so when I was, you know, first years of my life, like I wasn't proud of where I came from. I just wanted to be white. Like I didn't want to be different. And then after high school, I came back to the U.S. for college. I went to the University of Virginia. I studied something called Global Development Studies, which was, we were the first class to graduate with it. It was a small major. We were 22 kids, and you basically went into that degree if you wanted to change the world, which is what we all did, and from different perspectives. So some were doing it for public health. Some were wanted to go work for the UN. I was obsessed with microfinance, which is this idea of giving small finance to small businesses, and the particularly the businesses and the entrepreneurs who can't get credit or financing from traditional sources like banks. And so that's what I studied. And UVA, as it's called, the University of Virginia, it was really magical. It was a beautiful campus, really, really wonderful school that taught you. I think like the one thing I learned in college was how to think critically. I have to say, studying something called global development, which is basically anthropology, I graduated not knowing what kind of skills I would have to offer the workforce. And that was like, you know, I think my senior year of school, I was like, did I study the right thing? Because I don't know what I'm meant to be doing. But the one thing it did teach me was how to think critically, which I appreciate because I'm pretty sure that's a lifelong skill.
And then what happened after? When you graduated, what did you do?
So incidentally, I had interned, there was an Islamic, it was the first Islamic microfinance bank in Bahrain had opened. I spent a summer interning there, and I was a very opinionated intern. I basically asked the CEO to hire me when I graduated, which he said, sure. And so I graduated from university in 2011, which is the year of the Arab Spring, and the Arab Spring didn't hit Bahrain as heavily as it did in places like Egypt, but it, for such a small island country, it really decimated the economy. And so my senior year of college, I had this, you know, job lined up to go back home and work for this microfinance bank. And I remember calling the CEO. So I graduated in May and I called him in March. And he said, look, like none of my employees are coming to work. You know, the streets are full of protesters. Like I can't guarantee anything. And so I look around me and all of my peers who are graduating have, you know, consulting gigs lined up and different jobs. And I'm like, well, I have nothing. So I was a part of this student club called Student Entrepreneurs for Economic Development. We called it SEED. And we used to do, okay, this is what I mean by save the world types. So we used to do these consulting projects. God knows why NGOs would work with us because we didn't know what we were doing. But we would do these consulting projects with these different organizations around the world. And so we were invited to this town hall meeting in Charlottesville, Virginia, where I went to school, about a potential microloan program for the local community. And so I was at this town hall meeting and they were talking about starting a microloan program. And there was these three business leaders in the community who turned to me and said, hey, like, why don't you have some ideas about this. Why don't you work on this? And over the next couple of weeks, they said, look, we need somebody to write and research a business plan for this microfinance program that we want to start. Why don't you do it? Because your job prospects have disappeared in Bahrain, and you know, just stay this summer, and then maybe by then things will have settled, and you can go back. So that's what I ended up doing. So when I graduated, I stayed on in Charlottesville, Virginia, and we built this organization, and the organization's still going today, which is pretty cool to to see it blossom.
And then did you continue in the microfinance world?
A little ancillary too. So 2 years after, I was starting to get homesick, really, really homesick. I was living alone. Like, I lived in, so one way that we kind of bootstrapped CIC, this microfinance program, was my board members let me live in their extra houses. And so I'm living in a big house by myself for 2 years. That was taught me a lot about myself, frankly. But it was also very, very lonely. I mean, I had friends, but it's not the same. So I wanted to move back home, and home at the time was Dubai. My parents, in 2011, when everything happened in Bahrain, they moved to Dubai. And so I joined them in 2013. And again, like, graduating with a degree in global development studies, like, I really struggled for a long time with, like, what commercial skills do I offer this world? Like, how can I translate what I know? Like, I didn't learn coding, I didn't learn architecture, you know, I didn't learn any of these very concrete skills. And so there was this group that was starting the first incubator for startups in Dubai, and that seemed like a very similar experience in terms of helping to build this community. And so actually before I left, before I flew home, I was already applying for that job, which in hindsight I shouldn't have done, because there was a period in my life, which I hope I hope I've overcome, where I defined my self-worth by the fact that I was doing something, which I didn't. I hope I'm over that point. And so I was really terrified of, okay, what, I don't want to go home and do nothing. And so I think I was very quick to jump into the next thing when. I'm actually kind of curious if I hadn't done Impact Hub, what might have happened. But what I ended up doing was joining this team. It's called Impact Hub, which is this global network of incubators and co-working spaces around the world. I think they're in like 90 cities or something insane. And so we were building the first hub, the first Impact Hub for the Arab world in Dubai, which this was in 2013, where there were no co-working actually was not allowed. Like, there were no co-working spaces in the UAE, and there were no incubators. And so this was really the first of its kind of community, which I love doing. I love bringing people together, and I love building community. And so I was the first hire, and I managed the operations and built all the processes. And we built two startup programs for entrepreneurs, and It was great, and it was also extremely exhausting, and I burnt out regularly. Like, I remember my dad would drive me to work, and I would cry on my way to work because it was just way too much. Like, we were seeing hundreds of entrepreneurs a day, and I would stay at the office until like 2 a.m. and come back the next morning at 8. And I just poured so much of myself into that place, and it was really, really exhausting.
What was it about you that was attracted to entrepreneurship even back then?
I think I definitely, I think a lot of it was driven by what I saw in my father, for sure. I think it was just something that was familiar and something that I looked up to and admired. And then on a more basic level, I think I really like the idea of building things. I think there's something just, yeah, I love the idea of contributing through building a company that, you know, provides employment for people and provides a value or service to people, and figuring out how all of that works sustainably was always something that I thought that I really believe in. And I think this idea of, you know, being masters of your own destiny kind of thing is because you're running this company, you're building this company. I think, I don't know, that always attracted me a lot more than being an employee.
So you're in Dubai and you did 2 years of Impact Hub, working with entrepreneurs in the Arab world. At what point did you start thinking about your own company?
Well, so I left Impact Hub. So I really burnt out, and I had to take a couple of months off. And if you can kind of visualize this with me. So I'd been pretty steady on this career path for a couple of years of supporting startups, whether it was through microfinance or, you know, this incubator or business education or whatever it might be. And this is what I had studied in college and had read about in high school. And to feel so miserable, for lack of a better word, doing it, I really didn't know where that left me in life. So I took a couple of months off and spent them just thinking, frankly. And I actually spent some time with a good friend of mine who had this fireplace. This was wintertime, and I would like lie on the carpet next to the fireplace and just record voice memos to myself, which is pretty prescient given that we started a podcast company. But and I would just talk to myself and try and figure out, like, why was that last experience so hard? What had I done? Like, what role did I play in that? And what did I want to do? What could make me happy? And a couple of things came out of that, which one was I felt like I had stopped learning. And so I wanted to do something where I would, I could always just keep learning. And the second was I wanted to be more in control. I think the experience at Impact Hub where maybe I've matured and figured out how to do this, but I give so much of myself into whatever job I'm doing. And so I didn't trust myself to work for anybody else. Because only I knew my boundaries and like what was healthy for me, whereas somebody else might take advantage of how much I'm willing to put in. And then the last thing was I wanted to do something that I really, really believed in. And I didn't really know what that was just yet, but a couple of weeks into brainstorming, I thought of just telling stories would be fun and something that we really needed in the Arab world. And the choice of a podcast, it started just as a podcast. It didn't start as a podcast company, as you know, Dana, because you were there from the beginning. But the idea of starting a podcast was just because I loved podcasts and I was obsessed with them. And I thought that would be a fun thing to try. And of course, I had no idea how to do it at all. But when I sort of, when all of this kind of coalesced into an idea of, okay, let's start a podcast, there's this really awesome entrepreneurship program called MIT Arab Enterprise Forum that happens every year. It's basically the startup competition that you apply for. They accept a certain number of candidates, and then you all congregate in Riyadh or Kuwait or Bahrain or Cairo or wherever for basically a week of workshops and then this pitch competition. And the winners take home some cash prizes. And so I applied and I got accepted, went to Kuwait and did not win anything at all at this competition. But I did meet Ramzi Bashour, who happened to be the videographer capturing this whole experience. And he and I kept, you know, going off to the side and getting into these long conversations because he has a background in sound. And he ended up becoming our first sound engineer and still does some work with us today. And yeah, that's how Casey started.
Why did you call it Kernan Cultures?
So I didn't come up with the name, actually. I suck at naming things, like, absolutely. I don't even know how to nickname anybody.
I can attest. I can attest to poor choice of titles.
Pretty terrible. But a friend of a friend actually has an advertising company in Pakistan. And so he came up first. The first name he came up with was Delta, actually. And then he hung up and called back and said, no, you know, it sounds like a podcast, Kerning Cultures. And I was like, what does kerning mean? And so I had to Google it. And then when I understood what it meant, the metaphor behind the name of, you know, the spaces in between cultures was really awesome. And I thought that was perfect.
thinking of a podcast back then, especially in the Arab world, wasn't something that was really common. And I wonder if there was a specific episode or podcast that you listened to where you thought a version of this needs to be done in the Arab world.
Radiolab.
Tell me more.
Well, we've done an episode on Al Empire with Jed, so you guys will know my obsession with him and Radiolab, but it just is this beautiful, it instills such a beautiful sense of wonder into how the world works, from a science perspective, from a historical perspective, from a social perspective. And it's just these stories that decorate, you know, I love listening to Radiolab when I'm going on long drives or going for a run. And it just, they really, really take you up and away into these story worlds. And I wanted to do something like that with all the stories around me. So I would say one of the really great things about working at Impact Hub was, I mean, I was new to Dubai, but I would meet hundreds of people on a daily basis who would come through our doors, and their stories were always so inspiring. You know, these entrepreneurs who are building really, really cool companies that had never been built before in the region. And then I would turn on the radio in Dubai and you don't hear any of that, right? You just, like, literally, it's so bad. And I don't mean to hate on it, but really, we can do so much better with our storytelling. So I wanted to blend that. I wanted to tell really good stories that captured all the cool stuff that I knew was going on around us, and then figuring out how to do that, as you know, Dana, because again, you've been there since the beginning. That took several years, but that was the dream, at least at the very beginning, which we carry through to this day.
But you lost in Kuwait, and then you met Ramzi there, which was, I find, so serendipitous. And then how did you progress? How did you take that failure and then move forward? And, like, for any entrepreneur that's listening, what were the steps that you took after that little fall, I guess?
Yeah, well, so I went back home. So, by the way, I'm living at home, so I don't pay rent. So that's great. So I have some savings that I've had, because my costs are pretty minimal. I hired Ramzi, so he was the first person to join KC, and he taught me a lot about sound and recording and what gear to get and how to do interviews, and I basically fumbled my way through the first three episodes.
Your first few episodes were about entrepreneurship.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. You start with what you know. Yeah.
Today is part three in our series of startup scenes across the Middle East. This time, we're looking at Egypt. A quick heads up, some of the recordings are in Arabic. Egypt is a very special place in my heart. I claim half my identity to this noisy, loving, energetic nation. A massive country of 90 million people, Egypt is home to some of the most influential media and creative exports to the rest of the Middle East. Music, film, and literature often start in Egypt, and known as well for raising a youth driven to make an impact. Young Egyptians.
So then you came into our lives and made everything better, and then we continued. It was the three of us. We just kind of fumbled our way through, and I think putting out, it was really important that we put out those first couple of episodes. And by the way, like, we launched with four episodes. I think we released them one a week, and then there was silence for like 6 months because it took so long to make the next ones. We thought we had given ourselves enough buffer, but it was not enough. But putting out those first four episodes meant that there was something out there for other people to hear, and so slowly that's how basically our entire team found us. So I think Razan, when I was looking for a producer, she replied back to me on Facebook, and we started working on a story about farming in the UAE together. And I just thought she was very, so brilliant, and I loved the way that she was approaching the story. And so I think pretty soon after, I was like, Razan, would you like to be my co-founder? And she said yes. And then I think Alex Atak found us through an article in The National, I think, or I actually can't remember. I remember meeting him for coffee the very first time because he had emailed us. And but I think those initial episodes and just putting them out there, as like I listen to them now and they're so bad, except yours, Dana. Yours is good. But
no, mine was so bad. It was like the audio quality was so terrible. Oh my God. Every time I listen to that episode, I have to laugh because I mean, none of us really knew what we were doing. But yeah, I guess we had a sense of story and just loved podcasts. So we just kind of, I don't know, we winged it.
Yeah, I think we were just imitating all the stuff that we loved. But even though those first episodes, like they really make me cringe when I listen to them, I think putting them out there for the world to hear was really important because it was a clear demonstration of what we wanted to do. And so literally everyone who was a producer on Kerning Cultures in those first couple of years found us because they had heard those episodes. And it said, you know, this is something I want to be a part of. So Razan and I invested our savings into Kerning Cultures, and we worked on it for 2 years together. And it was a haphazard team, right? Like people came in and out, people were volunteering. We went through a couple of iterations of different producers, and everybody was learning trial by fire, right? Like we just watched YouTube tutorials and took as many classes online as we could and did, you know, really bad interviews and just like we figured it out, I think, because it's not like we could, you know, go work for somebody around us. There weren't any other podcast companies in the Arab world, and there were very few podcasters at all to kind of model ourselves after. We were really, I think, modeling ourselves after all the shows that we loved abroad. And from a practical standpoint, I mean, I want to stress the fact that, like, I was in a very privileged position. I was living at home. My parents fed me, you know, like I had very few expenses. And so I was able to invest everything I had saved into, you know, commissioning producers or sound designers and things like that. But our costs were very, very lean, and we weren't making money. I think we spent our first 3.5 years just honing our craft and focusing on that part. And then in January 2018, there was an opportunity to apply for this accelerator in San Francisco, which is, it's called Matter. And it was one of only two accelerators in the world that I had ever heard of that focused on media companies. Because a lot of the times incubators and accelerators, they love to support like your typical tech entrepreneurship. And so this idea of supporting a media company was really quite powerful. And as part of the accelerator, they invested $50,000 US into your company. And so we applied, we got accepted. But that, I think, like really kickstarted things. Like now we had a lot more cash. And as part of the program, so it was a 5-month program. And at the end of every month, they had what they called a creative review or a design review. I can't remember the terminology now. But basically, you had to pitch your company to a room full of people, like different experts or different media professionals. And every person seated on a chair had a piece of paper where they would give you feedback as you were pitching. So your pitch was 5 minutes long. And at the end, you would get the stack of papers of every single idea that had run through every person's head, which was really, really helpful for Ada to hear what it was that you were saying in the ears of somebody else. And then B, for me to figure out like all the holes in the business concept and all the ways that we could try and tighten it. So on the back of Matter, that's when we started fundraising properly for our seed round.
Matter was a really pivotal moment, I think, for us as a company, right? Because I think it was the first time that we kind of got a Western perspective on on the company and on our work. What were some of the things that you took away from that?
Yeah, I think Matter was really pivotal. And one of the biggest ways was, so I think language is really powerful, and the words that we use and the things that we tell ourselves become the realities in front of us. And what I mean by that is, before Matter and during, I would say up until probably 75% of the way through the program, I referred to Kerning Cultures as a podcast. And it's interesting because when we applied to Matter, I talked about it as a podcast network. But in all of my day-to-day language and in the signature of my email and the business cards that we used, I talked about, I have a podcast, Kerning Cultures is a podcast. And Matter, the reflection of that in the program always came back and said, don't you want to build a network? Aren't you a network? Like, think bigger than just a podcast. And that was when that all switched. So business cards changed, email signature changed, the way that we pitched the company changed from Kerning Cultures. Like, it's so interesting. I see at our home in Dubai, in my parents' home, on our fridge, we have these stickers that we print. Like, throughout our years, we keep printing these stickers, and it says Kerning Cultures, a Middle East podcast. You know, like, even little things like that. And so I would say that was the biggest takeaway of Matter, is like really the structural shift of, we're not building a podcast, we're building a podcast network. And then that just kind of, that change filtered down into everything that we did. And we started to think about new shows. We started to think about, you know, producing in Arabic. We started to think about a bigger team. Like, everything was, when you're thinking so small, it was always going to just be that small, you know, opening up the lid, frankly.
How did you get investors to invest in a company that was very much MENA based? And what was your elevator pitch to them about Kerning Cultures?
So we have investors in the US, but we have investors, most of our investors are in the region. So that sell was much easier, I would say, from the perspective of investing in an Arab company for the Middle East. What was really hard was to get investment into a media company, because people don't invest in media. And especially, I mean, we've talked about this on some episodes of Kerning Cultures and just in general. I mean, the startup scene in the Arab world is still very much in its beginning stages. And so the ecosystem is still building out from a capital perspective, from a talent perspective, from a market perspective, all of that. And so the investment that exists more often than not will go into typical either real estate, or it'll go into more traditional tech companies. And so to come and say, I'm a content creation company, give me money and I will give you a handsome return, is really hard. That part was really hard. But I think what really tipped it for us was the global landscape. So the fact that Spotify spent $500 million on podcast companies that year, and it happened, like, we closed our round in May, and I think the Spotify acquisition of Gimlet Media, the American podcast company, for $230 million, which Kerning Cultures is very much modeling ourselves after, that happened like a few weeks before we closed. And I remember as soon as I got that email, I forwarded it to all of the investors we were talking. I was like, see, this is going to be us, you know, this is going to wait a couple of years. And we're the Middle East podcast industry is where the US podcast industry was 5 years ago. You know, this is our moment. Like, if you want to ride this wave, like, get in on it now. Yeah, so that's how we did it. But it was really hard. It took us 8 months. It took us 8 months to close our seed round.
How did you have the amount of insight to and the confidence to be able to say, Kerning Cultures is going to be like Gimlet Media, give us a couple years? Like, that is a really big statement, and I believe it myself, but because I also believe in you and believe in us as a team, and because I'm intimately involved, but to others, that's a big statement. And how did you, like, where did you get that kind of confidence and that strong vision and just conviction.
So I think, and I've heard a lot of entrepreneurs say this, and actually Ghislaine from the Modus talked about this as well, that like if you have this pain point as a consumer, as an ordinary citizen, if there is something that's bothering you in this world and you create a solution for it, chances are there's a lot of other people who are having that same experience and want that same service or good that you've created. And so I think the conviction in KC is born out of that first and foremost, that media, mainstream media in the Arab world is not made for us kids. It's talking to our parents' generation. It's very politicized. There's always an agenda behind a lot of it, or the other extreme. It's very, very superficial stuff that just is, you know, made to pass the time. And we're more intelligent as a species than that. And we deserve more, and we deserve things that will feed our curiosity. And so I believe that very much. And so I think it's born from that. And then I would say the real confidence comes from the way that listeners and our audiences respond to our stories. And you know this. I mean, we have this channel on our team Slack called Listener Reviews, where people are always pasting ratings and reviews and comments that people have sent them. And if you don't need any more encouragement than that. There's a comment from a listener on a daily basis of how our stories have, you know, made them love themselves a little bit more, or brought them to tears, or, you know, taught them something, and there's magic in what we're creating, and that's what we're just fueling. That we're going to continue to tell more of these stories, and there's a business case behind that, because we spend so much time watching, listening, consuming media, and you can monetize that.
I wanted to ask you about also the way that you hired, and I guess as a leader of a company, what you were looking for in the people that you hired, and also like the kinds of stories that you were committed to. KC is a very non-political, non-sectarian. We're very, you know, we tell human-centered stories, but I wonder if that was something you wanted from the very beginning, or as a result of the people that you hired, or talk to me a little bit about building your team and with that your mission and your values as a company.
I have to say, I don't think that, like, we never, and you can tell me this as well, Dana, from those early days, like, I don't really remember sitting down and writing down necessarily our values as a company. I think we've started to do that in the past 2 years as we realized, like, there was sort of a self-selection into KC in the early days, and still to this day. And now as we continue to grow, we're like, oh, we need to write down what it is exactly that we are, and, you know, what pulses through our blood, so that people know what to look for and we know how to hire them. But I don't think it was any sort of, we weren't very formulaic about it in the beginning, but what I will say that we've been really blessed with, alhamdulillah, has been attracting incredible talent, and really passionate individuals who really pour their heart and souls into this storytelling, and everybody works so hard on our team, whether they're part-time or full-time, and I feel very honored to work with such incredible humans. I think one element that has been, I would say, curated, there has been an intentionality behind the spread of the team, and the fact that we're all from, you know, we're from Lebanon, we're from Palestine, we're from Saudi, we're from the UAE, we're from Egypt. Like, that wasn't accidental. I think that was something that we scouted for and selected based on that. And so you can hear that in the kinds of diversity of the storytelling. And then I think another thing that was intentional was we're a very flat organization, right? It's not like we all make decisions together and we decide what shows we want to do next. And I think that sort of buy-in from everybody on the team on what we're working on also mean it seeps through into the editorial decisions that we make, that everybody feels comfortable with the story that we put out. And because we are, like, all of us, I mean, we're all in this for the same reason, that we all really believe in good storytelling from the Arab world. But we all have, you know, we have different backgrounds and we were raised differently. And I think that the fact that, like, every story is a collaborative effort means that the output is going to be this kind of apolitical, whatever. Like, we're all more interested, I think, in the people and the personal stories than we are in trying to drive a certain agenda.
It's true. Okay, so we were one podcast show called Kerning Cultures. Then over the past 2 years, since we got our first investment, or I guess we finished our first round of investment, we now have 7 shows. Over the past 2 years, and we've grown exponentially. We hired an Arabic team, what I always saw in you was a vision for Arabic language podcasts, and that's something that you've said from the very beginning, and that's become possible over the past year and a half. And I wanted to talk about that. I want to talk about that process and that decision making, and also, I mean, it's been pretty successful. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, I think so. There's always going to be, I think, there's always going to be space for English podcasts. But just by statistically speaking, it's a harder road ahead because you're in a much more saturated market. There's a ton of Western shows in English that listeners can tune into, ourselves included. I mean, that's how we all started, was listening to those shows. So we always knew that we wanted to move into Arabic production. I think we used the flagship Kerning Culture show as this experimental ground where we dropped a couple of Arabic episodes that would actually perform better than our English episodes, and that was a good indication. And we would play around with styles, and it was just this sort of like catch-all for anything we wanted to try, whether it was a producer challenge, which was a good one, and we're going to do another one. And when we closed our seed round, that was first priority was to build out an Arabic team, an Arabic production team. There are more podcasts and podcast producers across the region, but it's still a case of we had to hire. It's still a case that there's so few. We're a very rare breed, us podcast producers, that we hired good storytellers first and then trained them on the audio piece. And so the sort of 4 of us, Dana, you, Alex, and Bella, we and Muhammad, who's been with us for the past 3 years, had been, you know, learning trial by fire of how to do this well. And so when we hired the new team, the first order of business was just training. And that took, I mean, they ramped up ridiculously fast, which is just a testament to how talented they are, alhamdulillah. And I think also to us in terms of how, because we had done it for the past couple of years, like we also saved them, I think, a lot of the angst that we went through. They were awesome. We ramped up and yeah, that's all.
Hey, Bum, who are you married to?
Who am I married to? I'm married to a wonderful man.
Tell us about it. Tell us about him.
His name is Mahmoud Abdussalam. He'll probably cringe at the fact that I'm talking about him because he likes to say that he has a no media policy. But I bring him up as often as I can. He's wonderful. He's a software engineer and he's Egyptian, and he has really become my partner in Kurdish culture. So when the Razan stepped back 2 years ago, it's really hard. Alhamdulillah, we have an amazing team, and I think I lean on all of you. And there's times where, like, I need to turn and talk to somebody about a strategic decision or brainstorm something. And he's become that, really. He's really like my business partner in Kurning Cultures. I can't thank him enough for the support that he's given me over the years.
What is your family, your siblings, and your parents? What do they think of Kurning Cultures?
They're really proud. My dad's been he's been a wonderful support from the beginning. I mean, I used to make him listen to our early episodes, and we'd sit and, like, he would critique it and give some feedback, and every person he talks to, he likes to talk about Kurning Cultures. And I told you, my mom started listening to us for the first time when we started launching Arabic. The first show she listened to actually was Bihub, and she loved it. She loved it so, so much, and then sent it to all of her friends, which really meant a lot to me. I think it's interesting because my mom was actually, she was a journalist. She was a translator, and she was a journalist, and I don't think I put those two, I don't think I put that together, that I followed so perfectly in her footsteps until quite recently. But my parents are really proud. My siblings are also really proud. And I think it's been, it's like they're all patrons on Patreon. And they're, you know, they come to the listening parties and that we have, I think they're really proud of me, which means a lot, as I am of them. I mean, they're all hotshots and in their fields as well.
I know that you talked a little bit about your vision for Kurning Cultures and waking up every day and kind of having that vision, but can you tell me more about what you would like, where you're going with Kurning Cultures and what you would like to see in the next 5 or 10 years?
I know I say this in jest, but I mean it. We're really building an empire, and we're building a media company that we can all be proud of. I think that is something that we all really believe in. And it always drives me crazy when I talk to friends who say, you know, there's nothing cool happening in the Arab world, right? Like to get good music, you have to go to Berlin, and to get good coffee, you have to go to London, and that's just and it's a consequence of the fact that we don't tell our own stories. And so I want to change that. I want us to look around for all the stuff that can inspire us, as opposed to looking outside, and to do that through really beautiful storytelling across genre. I mean, I think it, like, I'm so excited for this fiction show we're working on, and we're, you know, we're just getting started. But I really believe in that because we're a very young, we're a very young population, right? 65% of the population of the Arab world is under the age of 35. It's 140 million people between the ages of 15 and 35. And that is, yeah, I mean, if we're able to help shape perception of who we are and get to know more about ourselves. And I don't mean just like, I think one of the really beautiful things about Kurning Cultures is that we tell stories from across the entire region. Like that's pretty unusual. Normally you just watch TV shows made in Egypt or made in Saudi, or, you know, and so to hear these voices from Sudan and from Philistine, and I think there's something really powerful in that, getting to know each other a little more. And from a commercial perspective, I mean, we're building an incredibly profitable company, inshallah, built on an audience that loves us very, very much. And, you know, it's a young, educated, affluent audience is the typical demographic of a podcast listener. And so that's a good market to advertise to and to sell to. If anyone's listening from these places, I'd really like for Spotify or Deezer or Amazon me to buy us in a couple of years. That'd be great. Thanks.
I'm sure people don't know this, but Hiba and I, and actually a lot of members of the Kerning Cultures team, worked together for years and years before actually meeting each other face to face. And Hiba, you and I worked, I think, for like 3, maybe even 4 years before we ever met, and how long we've been working together now, for over 6 years, and we've met only a handful of times, but it's kind of amazing how you can feel so much love for a team and for a person without ever seeing their faces. But our company is so global. I mean, maybe you can also tell people, like, how does a team that's across 6 countries and 9 cities operate? How do we do it?
It's magic. How do we do it? Well, it's funny given the time that we're in with COVID, because a lot more companies are embracing this way of life. And I think, you know, we did it just out of circumstance. But I think this is the new norm moving forward. We function, I mean, digitally. That's the power of the internet. And so we work in a lot of collaborative docs. And so all of our scripts happen in Google Docs, where people can be commenting in real time and you're all working on the same document. It's awesome to work in audio, because audio is much lighter files than something like video is, which is, you know, gigabytes and gigabytes. Our interviews, I mean, this interview, we've been going an hour and a half, will probably be a couple hundred megabytes. And so that's easy to put up in Dropbox and exchange files and folders that way. We have a Slack group for our team, and so different channels for different purposes. And that's a quick way to talk to each other. And then I think the other things that really help is that we do regular check-ins as a team. And so they are typically audio conference calls, because we're now big. And so it slows down internet, and we can't hear people if we turn video on. But we do weekly check-in calls, what we call a stand-up, every week as a team. And that's just once a week, a dedicated time where we can all touch base with each other and troubleshoot any issues and talk about any wins and things like that. And then every segment of the company has their own internal regular check-ins that they do on top of that. We have WhatsApp groups, and I think that really helps. And I think the other piece is we're also really intentional about sharing as much as possible and getting together physically in person as often as we can. So we try to do as many reunions as we're allowed. And then even small things like on Slack, every person has a profile photo. And I think that little things like that just really help make it feel like you're actually talking to a person, and help create that sense of a bond and a team spirit, even when we're, you know, thousands of kilometers away from each other.
You work so, so hard. Like, you not only have to check in with the creative and host and listen to both English and Arabic shows, and now 7 shows, and you're trying to raise more money, and you do marketing. Like, how do you stay sane?
Well, so it it's taken some practice, I would say that. And by the way, I'm not, you know, I drop stuff on the regular as well. So I get to the end of my day and there's a whole list of things I have not finished. And I'm trying to get better about making action. I call them action lists, making action lists that are more achievable within a single day, because I think that'll help with feeling like I've accomplished a lot by the end of the day. But I make a lot of lists, that's for sure. And then actually Mahmoud was the one who taught me this when we got married, because remember, I've never really worked in a typical office setting. Like, I love working out of coffee shops, in co-working spaces, my kitchen table. And so what that does is that blends your personal and your work life way too much. And so when Mahmoud and I got married, he is very clear. Like, he goes to work and he's at work, and then he comes home and he's not at work, which I was like, you can work all the time. My office is my backpack, you know, I can. And I would say that took a couple of months of adjusting. But I'm really, really thankful for it, that, you know, we have dinner together in the evenings. We'll do whatever we want, whether it's going sailing or hanging out with friends or playing board games, you know. And he also taught me that weekends should be sacred. And that I really, really treasure, sacred from the perspective that you don't work on weekends. And that really helps, because, like, I do, you know, on the regular, I'll do 12, 14 hour days, and it's easier to do it when you're doing something that you really love and really fulfills you. And so, like, switching between listening, I don't do as much production, you know, that anymore, but the little bits that I still touch are, like, they fuel me, you know, and so that helps re-energize, and then you can switch back to some of the more boring stuff, like, I don't know, putting a financial forecast together of how we're going to make millions of dollars. So that kind of switch back and forth actually really helps. And then the other thing is being able to switch off on the weekends and in the evenings. That part really really, really helps, so that the next day you can come back at it at, you know, with just as much mental, you know, mental and emotional energy, for sure.
I know that you sail, and now we know that you do kickboxing, but what are other things that you do to fuel your mind beyond, like, Casey?
I love dancing, and I used the salsa dance. I'm still trying to teach Mahmoud. I'm a really terrible teacher, so it's taking a really long time. But sometimes I'll just turn the music on and dance in my bedroom, and that's pretty wonderful. I really love puzzles, especially in the time of this quarantine. I find there's something so satisfying about finishing a puzzle, and that you can do it in a single setting is really great, because a lot of the work that we do takes weeks and months to see the final output. And so being able to do something in, like, you know, a couple hours is pretty great. I cook a lot. Growing up, I used to bake so much. And all of my siblings will continue and forever tease me for, you know, putting salt instead of baking soda and whatever else, and then different experiments of muffins and brownies and stuff. But I've always been cooking or baking, and that part I really enjoy as well. I think, yeah, I really think, like, the older I get, the more it's actually one of my first board members on CIC, on the microfinance program, he said this. So he used to be this big corporate hotshot guy at Pfizer, and then was in the venture capital world, and when he first said this, I was like, that's such a strange thing to say, but it's really something that I've thought a lot about. And he said, I really take pleasure in ironing my shirts. And it's because it's this finite time period. You know, it's 5 minutes, and you start with a wrinkled shirt and you end with this beautifully polished, pressed shirt. And here is your accomplishment for your hard work. You know, here's the reward for your hard work, and within a couple minutes. And so I think I seek those kinds of activities as a I like cooking and making puzzles and, you know, stuff that within a short time period you can see you have a reward for your efforts. Because so much of what we do, it takes a really long time to see the rewards.
I'm going to ask you finally a question that we've often asked our guests. Can you guess what it is?
My obituary? I don't know.
First two lines of your obituary. What would you want them to be?
I really don't know. And my sister will chide me for not thinking about this, because I think she thinks a lot about this, about what kind of legacy she wants to leave behind. And I don't think I think in those kinds of glorified terms, to be completely honest. I don't know. I know that I want my family to remember how much I loved them and how much time and the good times that we spent together and my friends. And I want the people that I've interacted with on this planet to, you know, think good things of me. But what that all looks like, I don't know. That's up to God. I don't know. I don't know what I'll leave behind in the end.
How about a multi-million-dollar podcast network?
Yeah, inshallah.
What are you going to do right now?
I think it's iftar time.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. No, it's okay. Well, it's more for Mahmoud. We have to get him food.
Yeah. Hiba Fisher, I love you so much.
I love you, Akhtar. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you for this and for everything.
Thanks for building this with me. Thank you, Hayati.
This episode was produced by myself, Tamara Rasamni, and Alex Atak. Sound design by Mohamed Khreizat and Alex Atak. Fact-checking by Zena Duwaydar, and Bella Ibrahim is our marketing manager. Our original sting was composed by Ramzi Bashur. For the last time this year, thank you so, so much from the bottom of my heart for listening to El Empire. I deeply appreciate it. Just so you know, we're beginning the summer season of our other English show, Kerning Cultures, the OG show, next month. There are stories on there that I'm so excited for you to listen to. If you aren't already subscribed to that, please make sure you do that now. So in whatever podcast app or platform you're listening to, search Kerning Cultures, that's Kerning with a K, and hit subscribe. And maybe while you're at it, hit 5 stars and write a really nice review, just in case you have a moment. All right. Thank you guys so much. I hope you're well. I hope you're safe. I hope you're home. And I'll talk to you soon. Take care.